with a compelling perspective on global politics. This is the Patrick Henningsen Show on TNT Radio.
And welcome back to the Patrick Henningsen Show, wherever you are in the world. I'm Basil Valentine, sitting in for Patrick today, Wednesday, the 24th of April, 2024. What a great conversation with Rami Nohemann in that first hour. And in case you missed it, that brave soul is in Istanbul waiting to join the Freedom Flotilla Coalition and sail with 5,500 tons of humanitarian aid to Gaza. Strongly recommend listening to that particularly erudite and eloquent gentleman. Sometimes it seems like you only get bad news, and I'm afraid today is one of those days, certainly on the home front. The diminutive, soon-to-be-ousted Prime Minister of Great Britain, the unelected Rishi Sunak, has been in Germany alongside his equally inadequate counterpart, Olaf Scholz. They held a joint press conference at which they beat the drums for war. Sunak said he will not shy away from further public spending cuts. In other words, spending on things like roads, hospitals, schools, street lighting, disability benefits, things that might actually benefit the people of Britain. But he's not going to shy away from cutting them in order to boost military spending. As he faced questions over how the policy is going to be funded, the Prime Minister is now committed to spending 2.5% of the United Kingdom's gross domestic product on defence by 2030. That's an increase of more than £75 billion over the next 6 years compared with current levels. However, economists are saying, where are they going to find the money? Worth remembering as well that increased defence expenditure only ever has a detrimental effect on the economy, as well as standards of public life. Money spent on defence contractors, often overseas, only a tiny proportion of it is recycled into what economists call the multiplier effect, whereby people in receipt of the money spend it on other goods and services, and similarly, so do they. And we end up with a growing economy, but expenditure on so-called defence, not quite sure who we're supposed to be defending ourselves against, the Russian bear, no doubt, is one of the least effective ways of doing so. All this on the day when the United Kingdom was accused by Amnesty International of deliberately destabilising human rights globally. So in other words, Sunak has decided he wants to spend more money on weaponry so that we can continue to destabilize human rights around the world. That seems like an excellent place to bring in my next guest, Tony Gosling, who is a veritable expert on all things military, as well as all things United Kingdom government. Welcome to the program, Tony.
Thanks very much, Basil. I mean, I do see psychological warfare as a key thing for any journalist to get their head around and understand. I mean, I wouldn't pretend to be an expert on battlefield, but I think one of the things I've realized over the years is you've got to watch very, very carefully information coming from all sides in order to assess what's really going on. And I see a tremendous amount of propaganda, Goebbels style stuff coming from the West, particularly about Gaza. And once you realize that they're lying to you about one thing, you know, you start to realize you can't trust them about anything. I mean, Sunak, this PM guy, he's quite clearly a crash and burn character. He's not going to be there in 6 months' time. He's pretty much maybe 8 months, he'll be gone. And so they're doing exactly the same as they're doing with our mayor here in Bristol, in the UK, which is, for example, our mayor is passing through all sorts of disgusting, horrendous planning permission for these big fat cat developers before he goes, because he knows that he's not standing and he's a bit of a loser. So that's the sort of, anyway, back to the PSYOP. And, you know, isn't it interesting? Last week we had this announcement by Sunak about cutting benefits for the unemployed. In fact, what he was talking about, even though he didn't admit to it, was the benefits that are being paid to the employed. Most of the benefits are now paid to people who are in work, but he wants to cut those as well. And yet he's trying to say that this will be an incentive for people to go to work. So, I mean, basically, our economies are failing, as you know, in the West. The Chinese have done extremely well by a simple fact that their cost of living in China is so much less. They don't have to pay their workers anywhere near as much because they're not paying much for their accommodation, their energy, their transport. All these things are in the hands of the Chinese government, who are making the infrastructure available pretty much at cost to the public and to manufacturers. And so we've got a failed model, in an economic model that's had it through too much privatization of our infrastructure in the West. And so he's saying we're taking this money away from these people we've got to support, otherwise they'll be out on the streets. And we're giving it to, what is it? The defense budget. He's just operator for Goldman Sachs, the Bilderbergers, who Goldman Sachs were very, very close with, and Sunak's former employer was Goldman Sachs. And this is the deep state. This is one term that we're seeing occasionally asked, and even Sunak himself was asked about it a couple of weeks ago, are really running the show. Sunak will do anything they say and everything they say enthusiastically and sell it to the public like an old broken down Austin van used car salesman. And that's the kind of character he is. He's trying to sell all this stuff to the public, and people are believing it less and less.
We don't live in a democracy, as you know, Tony. We live in an oligarchy, or perhaps even a plutocracy. Sunak is worth about £570 million. How can he possibly know what it is like to live on benefits or even on an ordinary wage of £20,000, £30,000, £40,000 a year, where you actually have to budget to make ends meet? I think it's a really damning indictment of our political system that, without even going to the country for a general election, the Conservative Party can install. I mean, he was crowned effectively after the downfall of Liz Truss. Somebody who, listen, I've no objections to somebody having that much money, but not if they're going to pontificate to the rest of us about what we should do with what little we have.
Well, yeah, we've had wealthy leaders in the past, but there's a difference between someone who does care about the population they're supposed to serve and someone that doesn't. And Sunak is clearly somebody whose eye is on his next job. So, yeah, I mean, and what we're going to get, of course, as a result of all of this, is almost certainly Keir Starmer to be the political leader. I mean, I heard from an insider, this is probably 18 months ago now, someone who works for the civil servants trade union, that they were convinced that the Conservatives didn't want to win the next general election. So Sunak is the perfect person. I mean, I don't know. We could even speculate about why that might be. Economic troubles, war, that sort of thing ahead. But Keir Starmer is quite clearly going to be most likely candidate to be taking over. So this will be a kind of coronation, you know. This is medieval style stuff. But look, on the positive side, I do think that a lot of the policies, like this benefits policy they're trying to push through, are going to fail. I don't think they're going to be able to do these kinds of changes to the system, which will leave so many people being evicted from their homes, destitute, still going to work. And they've created a system where work is no longer a route out of poverty. So quite where we're heading is difficult to know. But I think the belief in our political classes has its own way of working its way through the system to make a bit of a correction or a reset, because people just simply don't believe what they're being told. And so you can have a policy, you can promulgate it all you want, a bit like trying to send the commandos, as they did try to do to Afghanistan. They just refused to go. And so I think, to a large extent, a lot of the civil society in Britain is just going to simply fail to comply with a lot of the legislation they're trying to push. I mean, like this Rwanda business to try and stop the migrants is a total joke. It's never going to work. It never was going to work. And the idea, it seems to me, ultimate idea, is to discredit the democratic political system To bring in a fascist system. That's what I think they want to try and do. And we're in that kind of situation anyway, with these big mega corporations like Tesco's and Shell all making these record profits through price fixing because there is no regulation. We are in living in a country now which is pretty much run by these global corporations anyway. So in a way, it doesn't almost make much difference. It would have been, of course, a big difference if somebody like Jeremy Corbyn had got in. I don't think he was a particularly good leader in terms of his wisdom as to how to run a political party or run a country. He seemed to be unable to really confront people who were his deepest enemies. But of course, it would have been a serious challenge to these big corporations and to the sort of fascist system that they're slowly but surely getting us used to. And I don't use this word fascist, in a trivial manner or flippantly, because that I see this all around me, that the policies that are coming through have got really nothing to do with the will of the people. They're just simply what corporate bosses and the financial leaders are deciding, well, we want this policy, we want that policy, and it's pushed through regardless.
Indeed, that's been the case for 45 years since the end of the Callaghan government in 1979 and the death of the social contract, as far as I'm concerned. 45 years of stagnant living standards and total disregard for the wishes of interests of ordinary people. When there was a referendum, of course, on Brexit, it went the way it did and in such large numbers because so many people felt that they were unheard. And we now have a situation where we have two avowedly, unapologetically pro-genocide, warmongering, Zionist, neoliberal, authoritarian parties, with barely a cigarette paper between the two. I mean, the Labour Party, since Corbyn was deposed, has moved so far to the right, but not in a good way, not in terms of the libertarian free market right, not in terms of restoring the great traditions and privileges of the people of Great Britain. No, in an insidious neocon authoritarian right. Am I right, Tony?
Look, yeah, of course you are. This time, the key text on this is by Michael Hudson, I think, to actually understand what's really going on in the world. You have to look, I mean, and this is literally, you've got two different economic systems at war in Ukraine. You've got a Western system, which is finance capitalism, which means that money can buy up political parties, it can buy up TV stations, it can buy up anything that an oligarch finds irksome. On the other side of the coin, in Russia and in China and the other places, Iran as well, you have a government that understands that it must keep its hands on these infrastructure, and also it must quite strictly regulate the tools of power, like the political system, and particularly the mass media. And so, what's Michael Hudson talks, I think, is in his book is. Industrial capitalism, finance capitalism, or socialism is the title of it. He just talks you through the history of this clash between different ways of doing things. And what's happened really in the West is the financial oligarchy have taken control of the levers of power. I've done a lot of research over the years. I've done loads of investigations. I've just been carrying on doing my investigation and confirming really the evidence that I've dug up over the years about the murder of the TV Crime Watch presenter Jill Dando here in Britain back in 1999.
I want to come back to that, Tony. I want to hear about that.
Sure. Well, but the main one of the main topics I've looked into over the years is the Fourth Reich. So we all know about the Third Reich and Hitler, but I came across this guy Idris Francis, who was a member of UKIP. Then he got disillusioned with them at the right minute and joined the Brexit Party. But he passed away soon after. But Idris's uncle had been escorting Nazi war criminals during the Nuremberg trials. And one of these Nazis turned to him and said, "Yes, you have beaten us for the second time, but next time we will win, and you won't know what's happening until it's all over." So this was a cheeky Nazi at Nuremberg chatting to, I think he was a captain in the signals or the intelligence corps, his uncle was. And he said this passed down through the family. And he'd always then been a bit of an anti-EU campaigner, because he, as many other people, noted that in 1941, Walter Funk from the Reichsbank and Hitler's government had put together a plan for the economic management of an occupied Europe, occupied by the SS and by the Wehrmacht, and as it was at that point being occupied. So they had to have a plan to manage it. And this was called the Europäischen Wirtschaftsgemeinschaft plan, which is basically the European Economic Community plan. And it was a plan that which was resurrected after the war. And so what we got with the proceeds of the Nazi loot, which was laundered through Sullivan and Cromwell, the Dulles Brothers law firm in New York City after the war, was a financial empire. This money that had come through Switzerland mainly and Argentina was just invested into big corporations by the Nazis after the war, many of whom were in South America and many of whom were in the United States as well. But the key thing to understand about this was that they put Jews in charge of these businesses in order to disguise the fact that it was Nazi money. In fact, some of them may not have known where this laundered money had come from, or cared. If you're asked to run a business, you don't necessarily say, "Well, where has all this money come from?" You just get on and run it. That was the idea.
I want to talk more about the Fourth Reich. I want to talk about the Ukrainian Reich and Dmytro Kuleba declaring today that the era of peace in Europe is over. But first, we're going to take a short break with the network. We'll be right back with Tony Gosling. Fascinating conversation, as always.
TNT's David Curtin.
Rishi Sunak has been threatening that he will do this and saying, "Oh, we'll do this, we'll come out of the ECHR, that is, not anything else." But he hasn't done so. And then he's saying, "Well, if we're elected in the general election this year, which is highly unlikely, then we may come out, and we may give notice to come out if we're re-elected in 2024-2025. By that time, another year or 2 years will have passed, and another 100,000 or so military-aged men will have crossed the channel in small boats with not a single flight taking off to take some bogus asylum seekers to Rwanda.
David Curtin on today's News Talk, TNT. TNT is an independent global news talk station that does what others only say they do. TNT is a live radio and TV broadcaster that simply tells the truth 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. No one in the world does what we do, crisscrossing the globe, providing credible news and opinion all day and all night. In 2.5 years, TNT has become a credible and exciting platform with brilliant hosts and staff. It's a critical time, and we must continue to call out the misinformation and propaganda from mainstream media and their powerful sponsors. We're now appealing to our many friends and supporters around the world to go to tntradio.live and make a small donation to TNT while we seek the right investors to continue our important mission. If you're still wearing a cloth or surgical mask around in public, you're guilty of spreading COVID misinformation. It really is that simple. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And welcome back to the Patrick Henningsen Show with me, Basil Valentine. In for Patrick today, Wednesday, the 24th of April, 2024. Some years ago, I went with Patrick to a talk by the late author Gerard Williams about his newly published book called Grey Wolf, which documents the flight of Adolf Hitler from the bunker in Berlin in 1945 all the way down to Argentina. Gerard then appeared in the History Channel TV series Hunting Hitler and various other documentaries, which purport to say that Adolf did indeed escape the bunker and lived in exile in Argentina until the early 1960s. Apparently, he was deluded enough into thinking that he might make some sort of return to power, but was kept out of the limelight by Martin Bormann, who ran the Fourth Reich from an office in Buenos Aires. There is no better person to ask about these kind of scurrilous rumours that undermine everything we were taught in school about 20th century history than my guest this evening, Tony Gosling. Tony, did Hitler die in Argentina in 1964?
No, he died in Berlin in 1945. In fact, the Russians filmed his body, his burnt body outside the Reichstag.
Well, they said that wasn't him.
Well, they would do, wouldn't they? Look, the guy was extremely ill by that point in the war. He'd been on cocaine-related drugs for many, many months by that point, and he was shaking. He was in pieces. And the idea that he would try to survive, I don't think he was that sort of person. He wanted to die in the flames of Berlin. But the interesting thing about this this whole myth of Hitler surviving was that it started in the late 1990s, around about the same time as this book OpJB was published by Christopher Crichton, which talked about Martin Bormann surviving the war. Now, the thing is, for many, I mean, this is quite a while, isn't it? It's 50 years or so, the 90s, after the end of the Second World War. Many people who were in the know about what had really happened in the bunker and who got out and who didn't were sort of dead by that point, pretty much. I mean, most of them were anyway. And so Christopher Crichton, his real name was John Ainsworth Davis. He was a spy for Winston Churchill throughout the war. In fact, the book OpJB is such a rip-roaring read. If any of your viewers get hold of a copy of it, you'll find it's almost impossible to put down. He talks, for example, John Ainsworth Davis talks about his role in Pearl Harbor. So there was a Dutch submarine that had spotted the Japanese fleet and radioed through saying, hang on, there's a massive Japanese fleet heading for Hawaii. And so this was around about Christmas time. He turned up to see that submarine around about the time of Pearl Harbor, or just after, and they gave him a load of Christmas presents. But actually, there weren't Christmas presents. They were explosives and poison gas in there that killed all the people on that submarine because they didn't want anybody to survive, particularly during the war, to tell the story that they knew, and they told the Americans that that the Japanese fleet was coming and that Pearl Harbor was not a surprise attack. So there's loads of stuff in this book, including the operation and support the Irish Free State was giving to Nazi submarines refueling on the west coast of Ireland, for example. But he went over to Berlin, and this is John Ainsworth Davis, right at the end of the war, in a crew of commandos trained down at Burdham, which is near Hayling Island, with the commandos, led by Ian Fleming. And Fleming came out just afterwards. Of course, people know the Bond novel author was also a officer in naval intelligence, and he was extremely good officer, apparently. So he took all these commandos into Berlin, and just before the end of the war, a few days before, Fleming was brought out, and John Ainsworth Davis and the other commandos brought Bormann out from Berlin. This was all prearranged because Bormann had been working with British intelligence towards the end of the Second World War, and they were brought along through canals through Berlin over a space of about 3 days, under the noses of the Russians, into the British sector. Now, you might say to me, well, of course, the Russians are not going to allow a load of British commandos just to go sort of swanning around. They're going to be challenged. And they were challenged several times by the Russians. But they had I think her name was Brabenov, who was part Russian, English, British officer. And she had a Russian uniform and spoke fluent Russian. So every time they were challenged, she would shout at them, we are pursuing Nazi war criminals. I have a direct orders from Marshal Zhukov. And if you dare stand in our way, you'll be court-martialed and shot. Yeah, so this is the way that the British managed to get Bormann out through this route. And he was handed a place called near Verben in the British sector, was handed over to Desmond Morton, who was Winston Churchill's private secretary. This is the way things are done. And in the book, he talks about, for example, going to visit Morton in Whitehall. And there was a movement behind. He turns around. It's the king sitting in there, George VI. So this was all arranged. This specific section of MI6 was all arranged and funded through the royal family during the Second World War. This is, I think, to me, is one of the most important books that explain what happened. In fact, in his pocket, Bormann had Adolf Hitler's last will and testament. And, from my point of view, looking at this whole story, I would suggest Bormann may have been the one who shot Adolf Hitler because they didn't want to leave anything to chance. He may have committed suicide, he may not. But I would imagine that Bormann was under orders to shoot Hitler to make sure he didn't survive. So the point is, anyway, he makes it to the UK through Desmond Morton. There's loads of embarrassment in Britain because the Russians are coming to visit and they're going to have a load of their KGB people after the war in the early 1950s. And so Bormann was not allowed to be in Britain at that point, by which time another book picks up the story, which was actually published 10 years or so before the one I just mentioned, Op JB, which is Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning. Now, Manning was nobody. He was CBS's main correspondent in Europe during World War II. So anybody in the United States listening to the radio commentary about what was happening with the war in Europe would have heard his voice telling them what was going on. He was doing things like going on daylight bombing raids with the US Air Force over Nazi Germany, coming back and giving his reports. But his book explains that Bormann was a bureaucrat who was taking this laundered money and setting up all these businesses. And to cap it all, there was a Hungarian called Ladislas Varago who was chasing these Nazi war criminals. I mean, one of the interesting questions in all of this is why weren't the Israelis at this point chasing these people? And I can explain that too if you want. But Ladislas Varago was in Buenos Aires and he got a couple of shots of Bormann in Buenos Aires in the early 1970s. So this is 40, 50, 60, 30 years or so after the war. And Bormann was Hitler's deputy and Hitler's private secretary, was born in 1900. So that's why I think we can be pretty sure he was in his, anyway, the photographs of Bormann from Ladislas Varago were published in the Daily Express one Saturday in 1972, front page, Martin Bormann is alive. And then there was just all sorts of things to try and cover this up. Oh, we've discovered his body. We've discovered his skull in Berlin. And then, of course, when this final book was published by John Ainsworth Davis, who was the key person who got Bormann out, so all this nonsense, I would say, about Hitler surviving started to be published and gained currency. So this is, I think, very Orwellian. It's an attempt to, control history. He who controls the past controls the future. He controls the present, controls the past. This kind of thing going on, and all sorts of people put up to this. As even the very first person that wrote about the Hitler bunker, Hugh Trevor Roper from MI6, published a book, I think it was 1946 or 47, about what had happened. There was lots of lies in that. I recently, discovered, I think it's Mark Felton, he does some very good YouTube military investigations. He's dug up a terrific recent story, which is about Bormann's secretary and how she ended up marrying someone from British intelligence and hiding for the rest of her life up in the Wirral near Liverpool, and then moving latterly to Cambridge. So she was just pretending to be an ordinary housewife, where actually she'd been Martin Bormann's private secretary right the way through the war officer of America.
I'm going to stop you there to redirect us to the present. The Fourth Reich, some people say it's the European Union. Of course, it's also this network of companies that Bormann set up. I agree with you about that. The European Union was supposed to be the bulwark against any future wars in Europe. And yet today, Ukraine's foreign minister has enthusiastically praised US politicians for approving the $61 billion military aid package and declared that the era of peace in Europe is over. This is unfortunately being echoed by half-wits like Hamish de Breton Gordon and various other idiotic talking heads in the British media. Please try and make sense of who on earth is calling for war in Europe.
Well, NATO is calling for war in Europe. NATO and the EU and the United States. Because this is their... I mean, I think we can just see the parallels between the Nazis and the Russians when it comes to the Soviet Union, anyway, before World War II. A lot of the effort for the Nazi war machine was thrown at Russia. If you go back even further, you can see Napoleon tried to destroy Russia. What we've got here is an obsession with taking down the Russian system, and particularly the Russian mentality. The Russia itself, as I said, is a very strong political system. There's lots of gangsterism in the country. But Putin is absolutely clear, I am number one gangster. And in fact, he realizes he could be assassinated any time. So he's set up a very genuine system whereby whoever replaces him will also be a protector of the Russian people and a protector of the Kremlin. Now, I mean, our own leaders don't really seem to be very interested in protecting their own people, just in trying to take out the opposition. The way that they took down RT, I thought, was particularly disgusting and disappointing. They've done, of course, the same with press TV to make sure these Russian views are not heard. When we had the terrorist attack in Moscow, the Crocus Theatre, just a few weeks ago, just after the Russian elections, none of the coverage of that, really, the Russian explanation of it was given here in the UK. They explained that, oh, these guys were here at the time of the election and they wanted to do the attack then, but the security was too difficult for them, so they went away and came back and did it afterwards when security was lax. We didn't really get any of that coverage here. So what we're getting is a very, very one-sided version of what's going on in the world. And to be quite honest, I think they've been planning this kind of Third World War for decades. I say they, I'm talking about even the predecessors, the ancestors of the deep state now. They've been trying to work this whole thing up for many, many years. Look at what's been going on. If I can just for a minute talk about the British over in Gaza and Palestine, you know, the First World War sweeping them out of the way, the Ottoman Empire, the Second World War implanting this crusader state there. But a similar thing has been going on, lots of geopolitics in Eastern Europe. For example, even the creation of the state of Ukraine in the early 1900s was just a fiction, really. It was just made up. They decided we're going to have this particular country in this particular position, a bit like they've been doing, of course, with the Sykes-Picot in the Middle East. So this, to me, is a very clear top-down mission that the NATO countries particularly, but all their hangers-on as well, are in twitches to threaten and take down Russia. Now, of course, they can never really do that. And the reason I think, to be honest with you, Basil, that they're so, afraid of Russia and they're so obsessed by Russia is because the main Third World War is planned between the United States and China. And both of those are controlled countries by the oligarchy, I believe, in different ways, different emphases on both sides. But the Chinese are controlled. I mean, I don't know how much you know about the origins of Chairman Mao being funded by Yale University, his bookshops being funded by Yale back in the early 1900s. This guy was brought to power by the Americans, by the Skull and Bones Society. And so these two major powers, the Chinese and the Americans, that's the idea for a Third World War. The thing is, the Russians are a third force. You see, if there is a war, a third force is going to be still probably surviving and may even win from a war between China and the United States. The Russians may well come out of it really well, in fact, the dominant. Okay. So that's why they hate the Russians, I think.
Okay, Tony. The third force, of course, in the James Bond books, is Spectre, is the criminal organisation that plays the two off against each other. But I wanted to just refer quickly to an article by Jeremy Corbyn in today's Guardian I'm very pleased that they published it, given the extent to which he was demonized during the whole phony anti-Semitism farrago. Our leaders seem determined to give war a chance. Their thirst for conflict endangers us all. And he references Christopher Clark's book, The Sleepwalkers, where Clark refuses to pin the blame for the First World War, the 1418 War, on a single power. Instead, he explains how political leaders narrowed the prospects for peace one misstep at a time and sleepwalked into a global catastrophe that left around 20 million people dead. I don't think they're missteps. I think they're deliberate steps. And if it happens again, it won't be 20 million dead. It'll be 2 billion dead or more, Tony.
Well, I can remember, gosh, must be 15 years ago or so now, reading a terrific novel by Dennis Wheatley, who was he's an occult writer, wrote the great occult novel of the 20th century, The Devil Rides Out, which was actually made into an excellent Hammer film as well. And Wheatley wrote this book, The Seventh Seal. It is a terrific, if anyone has not come across Wheatley, it's a terrific yarn about this officer that can see the First World War coming. He's got inside information about how they're trying to get it started. And he's frantically traveling around Europe trying to stop this First World War and the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand. And one of those things that you can see a lot of military people, I think, are those that understand just what how horrific and horrifying war really is. For many of us, we're quite prepared to kind of go along the bandwagon of, oh, you know, Assad has to go. Oh, dear, Gaddafi is a terrible, nasty man. Gaddafi has to go. Now, of course, it's come around to Putin has to go. Most military people these days will look at that and they'll say, well, hang on a minute, because you're not going to just get rid of Putin. What are you talking about? You know, we'll lose. If we just try and fight him, we're going to lose. So there is an air of unreality to this, and they're pushing along with it anyway, I think. So, you know, this announcement by the Ukrainian prime minister about, we are bringing war to Europe. Well, he doesn't quite say that, but that's what they're doing. They're trying to spread war like a disease, like a virus throughout Europe. And the way they're doing that is they're giving the Ukrainians lending the Ukrainians, in fact, all this aid money that's going away from the poor in Britain that desperately need it to feed their kids to Zelensky to spend on Western weapons. Of course, most of this money is coming back to the BAE Systems, the British arms industry, to people like Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, and it just bounces straight back. If it doesn't go, get lost somewhere along the way and get laundered over in Ukraine, it's coming straight back here, this cash. And so that's what they're trying to do, I think, is to boost our economies. And it shows you how powerful the arms lobby is by getting these arms firms to start manufacturing massive amounts of munitions for the Ukrainians. But the key thing is the missiles. I noticed there's another US missile, which is even longer range, that they're now considering sending to Ukraine.
That's right.
This forces the Russians to actually come further into Ukraine. The longer range your missiles are, the further the Russians need to come in order to stop you firing them at Russia and Russian cities. And yet none of this sort of thing is really discussed in the British press. But I can assure you that many military minds in the West know this 100%. And they know that if we were really to take on Russia in any serious way, we'd lose.
Very quickly, I promised listeners at the top of the last hour that you know who killed Jill Dando, the British BBC journalist shot dead on her doorstep in Leafy Putney 24 years ago now, a crime for which the entirely innocent Barry George was imprisoned for several years, and he never got any compensation either. That was absolutely outrageous. Newspapers full of stories that the Met Police are reopening this investigation, and they have a Serbian gunman, a Serbian hitman in mind. Can you shed any light on this grisly topic, Tony?
Well, it's good to see this bouncing back into the news again, because it is, as you say, a horrific miscarriage of justice. And right on our TV screens, execution of a TV presenter who was presenting a Crime Watch crime program. I think it's fair to say that, say, back in the 1970s and 80s, anyone who was a grass was going to get potentially get the lawn was going to get mown
off
if they were so. But the thing is that she's a presenter, she's a journalist in a way, like Julian Assange. So she's not the person who's doing the telling, she's the person who's the messenger. And so it was really extraordinary that she should be executed in that way in 1999. But there are a couple of journalists that I've spoken to over the last few years, or sources, I should say, one of them particularly an investigative journalist, Don Hale, and he has an immense amount of information about the British paedophile rings. For example, I remember him in an interview telling me that the people that knew most about the paedophile rings in London, which were largely used for political blackmail, and this was a big technique of the intelligence services, that anybody that was looks as if they were successful in getting to near power, they would be mixed up in these paedophile rings, even if they themselves weren't particularly interested. The connection with it would be so toxic for them, they could easily be blackmailed. And they'd be secretly filmed and this sort of thing. But he said the people that know most about this, far more than anyone else on the planet, is the KGB. The Russians had been following all this right the way through the Cold War decades into the 1990s and knew everybody, all the MPs that were involved, all the intelligence officers, and particularly public servants who were so easily compromised. So that was partly Don Hale's work, but he also worked very hard on the acquittal of Barry George, which was a brilliant thing to do. This guy basically was educationally subnormal, and he was fitted up by the Metropolitan Police a year after Jill's death for her murder, with the key evidence being one particle of cordite.
Gunpowder. Or, yes.
Yeah, gunpowder of some sort. One particle. And even the witnesses at the trial said, well, this could have come from anywhere. One particle, it could have been in that coat pocket when he bought it secondhand. You know, there's no way that you could say one particle is enough to convict the guy. But he was convicted anyway. Luckily,
amongst the evidence the police presented to court was the fact that he had an untidy flat.
Well, in which case, both you and I are going to have to go to jail, I'm afraid. Look,
Tony, okay, we've got to end it. Go on.
Okay, very quickly, the actual killers, Jerry Coulter, I interviewed, and you can still find his interviews up on the Daily Express website. He had been complaining about the police in Dorset and Freemasonry having stolen his car. And he put a website up about it, and he was told, contacted by these Eastern European mercenaries, we will kill these police officers for you. He went over to see them in Hungary, and guess what? They showed him the gun that they used to kill Jill Dando. And she had this list of paedophiles. She'd taken it to the BBC. They'd done nothing. So she took it to the Met Commissioner, Paul Condon. A few weeks later, or a couple of months later, she was executed on her doorstep. So that's what I believe happened, is a total failure of the police. Don't take it to the Met Commissioner. If you've got information like this, take it to journalists, get it out there, because she couldn't put it on the TV. But it'd be interesting to see if she tried to do that live. That would have been interesting. Read the names out live on the BBC. But anyway, she didn't do that, and so she ended up dead, I'm afraid.
Tony, explosive story. Thank you so much for sharing it with us tonight on today's News Talk. A fascinating conversation, as always, and I look forward to seeing you again very soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you,
Tony Gosling.
Cheers, Basil.
Cheers, Tony. We're going to take a short break now. When we come back, I'll be joined by State of the Union host Brian McLean. Yes, that's his name, to find out what's coming up after the news headlines at the top of the hour, and also get a bit more information on the impending American Revolution, with anti-war protests sweeping universities like no time since Vietnam. We'll be right back.
My baby's back from the West Coast.
Hear those pictures that you asked for your school project? First day of school, cute as a button.
So long ago.
Oh, here's Grandma Florence after that flood wiped out the whole neighborhood.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here.
I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe. And it's the best way to protect that legacy.
Ah, those beans smell heavenly.
Mm-hmm. Give Mom a little credit.
You know what? We should make an emergency communication plan. That way we're ready this year.
Oh, thank you.
At my dorm, we have emergency kits for earthquakes and wildfires, but I'm sure there's something more local I can send you with Elaine.
Okay.
Smart.
I'm coming to share with you guys.
Protect your legacy. Plan for natural disasters today. Visit ready.gov/plan.
Hi, I'm Abel.
I often forget to mention that he's an amputee because Abel will try any activity he can.
My arm helps me with basically everything.
He doesn't see what he can't do, he sees what he can do.
Yeah, okay. This is helping.
The War Amps has just given him the ability to do all the activities every kid can do.
When you donate to the War Amps, you help kids like me. Thank you.
This is the Patrick Henningsen Show on TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Patrick Henningsen Show with me, Basil Valentine, in for Patrick today, Wednesday the 24th of April, 2024. I did enjoy my conversation with Tony Gosling, who referred to the man framed, simple as that, for the murder of Jill Dando, Barry George. Tony used the term educationally subnormal to refer to Barry George. That's not a term we use so much these days. People like to use special needs, which is sort of less denigrating. Barry George was indeed special needs, and I would venture to suggest that somebody else who is special needs is the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Mike Johnson, who was jeered by pro-Palestinian protesters at Columbia University today. Johnson, of course, said that it's a biblical requirement to support the state of Israel, such as his simplistic understanding of religion, spirituality, and world events. And he's also been making idiotic noises about a new axis of evil consisting of Russia, China, and Iran, even though, of course, they're not responsible for the murder of 15,000 children. That's his big ally, Israel. So I'm not really sure he was expecting anything else. Johnson referred to what he called a virus of anti-Semitism at colleges nationwide. Johnson doesn't seem to be aware of the fact that there are thousands of Jewish students taking part in these protests. Brian McLean, host of State of the Nation, joining me now. Why is it people like Johnson are so blinkered that they can't see what's happening right in front of their faces?
Well, I'm not sure. It really begs that question. That's the million-dollar question right now. And, you know, with the amount of apparent astroturfing that I'm seeing going on, one has to wonder if he really is functioning on some sort of, you know, religious imperative, or if he's actually, you know, helping fuel the fire and creating this this media storm that creates headlines such as this one. Students are scared. Columbia crisis spirals as tensions simmer and protests continue.
Okay. I agree. The language around it is completely over the top. All the pictures and video I've seen of the protests at Columbia and elsewhere are of a sort of festival type atmosphere with students drumming, dancing, singing, listening to speeches, making cups of tea around their tents. Yet it seems not just the usual Zionist suspects, but even Democratic operatives like Joe Scarborough are chiming in with some nonsense about these events, which I will say again, are heavily populated by Jewish protesters. They're simply anti-genocide. They're not posing any threat to anybody. It's one of the most blatant and egregious cases of persistent misrepresentation I've ever seen. And of course, it deflects from the important issues.
Yes, absolutely. I was cued into a video on Basim Yosef's X.com account this morning. And it's pretty interesting. I would recommend going there and checking it out. He says, I saw a video on my timeline of people being paid to infiltrate the college protests to incite hate and chant anti-Semitic slogans. They call it astrosurfing. I don't know if that's a typo there, but astroturfing, I believe, is what he's talking about. Maybe astrosurfing is ludicrous speed astroturfing. But he goes on to say, at the end of the video, the organizer says they will go back to the office for cocktails and debriefings, and also mentions a $50,000 amount that was paid to organize some of these buses. So, you know, I think what we're seeing here, the media optics on what we're seeing here are really nothing new. And there's a massive amount of infiltration happening. So the people that we see in the mass media cartels broadcasts are the most salacious ones you can imagine, just like what happened at many points in the civil rights movement, in the anti-war Vietnam era, Occupy Wall Street, BLM. Antifa, Oath Keepers, Proud Boys, J6, PatCon, KKK, Ruby Ridge, all of these events had these type of people at them. If they're not federal agents of some sort, you've got NGO-sponsored people like this.
Not to mention January the 6th. I saw one blisteringly stupid post on the X platform likening the protests at Columbia and other universities to Charlottesville, in as much as they were sort of, I mean, what on earth kind of nonsense is that? I mean, let's not give that any more credence for just a moment. Mike Johnson was booed, I'm glad to say, flanked by other Republican members of Congress. He's called for the resignation of Minush Shafiq, Columbia's president, accusing her of failing to protect Jewish students. I mean, what evidence has he got that any Jewish students have been harmed in any way, shape, or form? I mean, it's actually a form of anti-Semitism itself. This is the irony of the thing, because Johnson is claiming to represent all, his views represent all Jewish students, and we know that they don't.
Yeah, that lack of nuance there, I always find that disturbing. You know, it's, there are all types of people being represented here, to include the nefarious ones that I mentioned, but the fact that those are the ones that are used to scaffolding the headlines around and the narratives around, and the other people are given no voice whatsoever, that is a huge, huge piece of this propagandistic gaslighting that we're seeing right now. And, you know, all activist movements begin on college campuses. You could go back to Vietnam and look at the teach-ins that they had there. And these things often lead to, you know, they can lead. I mean, look what happened at Kent State. These sort of things can lead to stuff like that, which can be used to push the overall narrative and polarize people against each other politically. And that's what we're seeing right here. And I'm afraid that Columbia University is going to be the first snowball that builds into an avalanche if this continues, because this will probably move to your side of the pond eventually, and we'll start seeing massive shutdowns of schools if this continues.
Sincerely hope so, because for all the attempts at deflecting attention from the core issue, this is about aiding and abetting genocide. There have been protests this week all the way across the United States, I believe, from Massachusetts to California, with scores of arrests, particularly at New York University a couple of nights ago, with police with batons moving in, really sort of images of fascistic type repression of what is supposed to be freedom of speech. I thought you had the First Amendment.
Yeah. Unfortunately, these college environments, they've already radicalized all these young people. These young people are so overtly radicalized, they're completely game for whatever the next hashtag marginalized people protest is going to be, especially if they get free sandwiches, hotel vouchers, and cocktails and a debriefing.
Well, for once, they found a worthy cause with Palestine. That much I will say. Finally, Hesha, what have you got on State of the Nation after the news?
Oh, we've got a great State of the Nation coming up today. We're going to Timothy Shea and I, we're going to be talking about the Senate passing this $95 billion aid bill. We've got Angela Stanton King, Joe Lombardi, Dr. Ron Martinelli, Senator Brian Jones. We have a power-packed show coming up.
And Joe Biden can't wait to sign that bill into law, loading not just current taxpayers, but taxpayers' children with billions of unpayable debt. Is that the way forward? I don't think so. I'm Basil Valentine. Thank you so much, Hesha, Brian McLean. Thank you to my previous guests, Rami Nauerman and Tony Gosling, of course. I'll be back tomorrow while Patrick is on his James Bond adventures. Don't go away. State of the Nation, right after the news headlines.